The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. Create, do, explore. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. Well, this week, Demi Isaac and Kai Widdrington became the latest couple to leave Dancing with the Stars. So it's back to the books for Leaving Cert student Demi, but with her head held high and a spring in her step. Tomás McInmary is a historian who cares as much for emotions and personal memories as he does for dates and statistics. Upon the release of his powerful book, The Time of the Tans, he joined me to delve into our history and the recollections of those who were alive when it was being created. As one half of the Rubber Bandits, the outspoken and highly entertaining Blind Boy Boat Club is the voice of a generation. His new book is about to be released. He's bringing his popular podcast on tour around the country. You'll have to listen in and prepare to be amazed and amused and bemused. And far from the lions and hangovers you might expect of a 20-something, Lauren Gaffney has written, staged and directed her very own musical, Big Shot, and has managed to convince a Tony Award-winning producer, who himself is a big shot, to come and see it this weekend in the Helix. We chatted about this huge achievement, which is hopefully the first of many. And that's it for this week. Hope you enjoy it. Until next time, thanks for listening. The time now being 9:25, and we, of course, we're all glued to
Dancing with the Stars on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Muller Corner. Mullerlicious.
Demi, good morning.
Morning.
Kai, good morning.
Good morning,
it's
Ryan.
It's great to see you, the pair of you. Demi, how are you today?
I feel, I don't know how I'm supposed to feel. There was a lot of tears last night, but there's no tears right now. So that's a good thing. That there's a plus right there.
The dance-off was, I mean, you had to dance off to say goodbye. What's it like getting up to do it all over again?
Nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
But Kai kind of gave me a bit of a prep talk before I went down. He was like, just act as if you actually have to dance again, like another dress rehearsal. And that's what I did, and I had fun with it. Like, I did stumble a bit, but I smiled, which I wasn't supposed to do because I was enjoying it, and it felt good. It felt good to just do it on a good high. So.
And yeah. Then, obviously, they had to say, and well, only one of you could go through, so the judges then decide that Fred goes through and you're it's over.
Yeah.
Obviously you cried, and it's because it's a big emotional.
Yeah, there's so many emotions.
Craziness
there,
going on. Yeah. What was going through your mind?
That I had to put Fred through that. I think that was the biggest thing, because I thought he was great and I didn't think he deserved to be in the dance off, but it is what it is. But to be up against someone that you start in the competition with, you're in rehearsals every day with each other, yeah. Literally, because Julia is Kai's other half.
Yes.
So we share the studio together and we're always working together and we see each other's flaws and we see each other work with each other from start to finish. So it's hard to be in that situation with someone. And I actually said I'm sorry before I went and I danced, because I felt so bad. And I was delighted that he's through, and it's great to see someone that I started off with, like I said, go through to the competition.
Now, Demi, I'll come to you in a second, Kai, so I'm not ignoring you. I'll just concentrate on Demi for a minute just to get the kind of the flavour of where she's at. Everyone keeps talking about and kept talking about the Leaving Cert with you, including myself at home. I'm going, now that girl needs to get back to the books and stuff. I was getting all kind of dad-like watching, going, what did she do? So where are you with that now?
I have about 4 weeks to study for my mocks. My school's already done theirs, but I'm going to knuckle down now and study for mine, and I'm going to do it. And then I have the Leaving Cert then in June, and hopefully the Young Offenders afterwards. So I think I'm sorted for another while.
Okay,
so
you're comfortable with that.
I'm comfortable with it, yeah.
Did you have to go back to school every Monday?
So there was Mondays when we always had Monday off, because I always needed to obviously go back and collect schoolwork. So when they were doing their mocks, I didn't have to go down, which was 2 weeks. And then when we had rehearsals, like the group rehearsals, I didn't have to go down. So there was about 3 or 4 scattered around the place, and I did go back home on the Sunday night, and I did collect work and then come back on the Tuesday morning.
Because it's intense. I mean,
it's so intense.
I can see, actually, I thought last night, because everyone's game was up last night, including yours. I thought you were really good last night. I thought you danced really well. But you can sense it. I think this happens at this point of the show every season. There's almost like a gear change where everyone goes, all right, it's got serious.
Yeah.
And that's why I thought it was a bit harsh that you had to go last night, because I felt that you'd given nearly your best performance, weirdly.
It was one of my favourite performances, and it was at the high score that we've ever gotten. So that was mad.
Yeah.
But at least, like I said, at least I left on a good high.
You sure did.
Like, imagine if I left last week with the Charleston, like, or like with the cha-cha when it wasn't my strongest performance. So I'm happy. Like, I'm yeah. settled down and the emotions have gone and I'm just happy with my performance.
You can leave with your head held. Why all the tears?
Because there's just so much. First, I felt so disappointed in myself because it's like, oh, I didn't do enough campaigning. I didn't do enough for the judges to like me. And then I felt bad for Kai because I was like, oh my God, like the choreographies that he had planned or the routines that he had planned for the future, they looked really good and it's never going to be used now. And there was just, I couldn't pinpoint it. It was just, there was so much emotion.
The head melt.
Oh, it was completely. And then poor little Johnny Ward came up to me when we were doing the little dance around and he just didn't want to cry because I didn't want to cry. So we just started singing and having a laugh. And then Cleona, bless her shoulder was gone and she was trying to hug me, but her shoulder's literally gone, like it's really bad. But it's just so much, there's so much emotion. Yeah. But the one emotion that I felt was love from everyone, and I'm happy. And I'm, like I said, I can hold my head high.
For sure. Love is all you need, Kai.
Absolutely.
Love is all you need.
Absolutely.
Tell me a bit about dancing with Demi.
It's been a real pleasure to dance with Demi. It's been a pleasure to see her grow as a person. Like, she came into this, she was only just 18 when she joined the show. She's the youngest contestant we've ever had. Yeah. So to see her grow as a person throughout this entire process is a real privilege. And to take this journey with her has kind of been a real nice thing for me to see. She's really progressed throughout this competition.
Like,
she did really, really good. So no, I'm happy and I'm proud of her.
I'll be very straight. I thought after the first week, at the first dance, I thought, I think she might be in trouble. I really did.
I thought it too.
So did we.
I'm not being rude.
No, you're spot on.
Yeah, I just thought, God, I don't think Demi's going to last the place here. But you kept going. In fairness to you, stuck to your guns. You know, obviously Kai saw, right, we've got a bit of work to do here. But you did the work.
Yeah,
she did the work.
No, that's the thing. In the first week, we had a bit of a moment where I was like, look, I need you to put more work in. I don't think we're doing enough here. I knew what needed to be done. I don't think Demi quite knew the kind of format of the show, how hard you actually needed to work. So we needed to do more, but we found a bit of a routine that worked for us.
I was watching it last night saying, I could never do it. I could never do all that intensity of the training, the trying to remember the where to put your feet.
No, the remembering is actually the easiest part. It's actually perfecting it. It's quite hard.
Is that right? Is that the hard bit?
We get the bones. That's what we used to say. We get the bones of it and the skeleton of the dance like on the Tuesday, Wednesday. And then after that, you know, you can try and perfect it. But that's the hard bit. Thursday, Friday is where it really kind of the nerves kick in for these guys. And they're like, it's fight or flight mode. And they have no choice, but they have to go and do it on the Sunday.
So. For sure. What are kids around the country saying to you when you're out and about?
You're an inspiration.
Inspiration!
And I'm like, oh my God, me, little old me. And they're like, no, like, I don't know how you're doing it with the leaving cert. Like, I have my priest coming up. I don't know how you're doing it. And I'm like, I don't know how I'm doing it either. So that makes the two of us.
Yeah.
I've got little girls telling me that they want to be me when they grow up. And I'm like, oh, stop. There's so much pressure now. But it's adorable. And I'm happy. Like I said, I came on the show to do what I needed to do. And that's what I did. And to hear people say that is an absolute pleasure. And I just want to keep going up from here.
One of the moments that stood out for me was when you danced with your dad's memory in your head.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to be gratuitously sad here for a moment. I'm just telling you, as a punter at home watching it, it made me quite emotional. And I've got a heart of stone. So I was quite shocked at my own reaction to it, because I think, if I may say so, it felt really authentic that you were, you really had your dad. Tell us about him. Would you do that for me and just remind us why that was so big?
My dad's name was Joe. I say is, but I'm going to say was because past tense, obviously. And he is like my rock. He's my stone. He's like the person you'll go to if you had a problem. He'd bend over backwards to make sure you're okay. If you needed something today, he'd do everything that he could to get it for you. And that was just my dad. So for him to die, to go, was probably the hardest moment in my life. Mm. And when you've got four younger brothers, a newborn literally in the house, it's tough. You just have to be strong. So there was a stage where I wouldn't. So, like, people seeing me cry on the show, especially people who know me, is like, whoa, that's not Demi. Like, Demi doesn't cry. And I don't cry. So for me to cry on the show just shows that there's a lot going on that people just don't know about. So when I did the song for my dad, it was the toughest. Not the routine. The emotion of it was so hard.
How old were you when your dad died?
I was 15.
And how did he die?
He had a brain tumour, but he then had further complications. His immune system was down, so he was prone to all sorts.
So and 15, you, 15 you, that's yeah. only three, just about three years ago. Yeah. So no wonder it's so vivid in your head, that the loss. How old were you when your mum died?
I was 5. So it's about 10 years after she died that he died too.
There's a lot going on in your world.
There's a lot. And then my auntie died then a few months later, and there's a whirlwind of stuff.
Yeah. Have you confronted all... I mean, you're only 18 now, and I don't mean to patronise you when I say that, but have you confronted all of that that loss, do you think? Have you talked to people about it, or have you just decided I'll deal with it another time?
Before, when he was sick, because he was severely sick, like, my dad was using, like, wheelchairs. He couldn't walk. His feet were just... There was nothing in his feet. Like, we had to put on his socks. Like, that's how bad it was.
Yes.
And I remember the school, they advised me, because I was really angry. I wasn't sad. I was just just angry. So they advised me to go to counselling. And then from there, we kind of pointed, like, where the anger was coming from. It was just for me to mask my sadness. And that's when I realised that there's just, people just don't seem to understand. And I think people going through what I went through, or even worse, you should find help, because it's the only way to cope with it.
I spoke to an author here last week or the week before, Patricia, and she's about 58, thereabouts, as she told me. And she talked about when her husband died, and, you know, young.
Yeah.
And she said that anger was a big component of her grief. I think that's something that people, you know, don't quite... I think she spoke to people too, like you did, and that just helps the anger calm down a little bit. And your stepmother?
Yeah, Kim.
Kim, who I met when you were on the show, great woman. And she's a big supporter of yours.
Oh, she's my number one fan. Like, you should see, she has, like, cuttings of all the newspapers that I've been in since I was a kid till now. And it's mad. Like, it's like a big shrine inside the house. But, she's my number one supporter. She's been there since day one, especially with my mom and my dad. So she knows me from... She's seen my ups and she's seen my downs. And last night, she cried. But she was so happy because I left with my head held high.
You sure
and
did.
That's all I wanted to do.
I met you in the roadcaster, the chip van, as I call it, that time in Clonakilty.
Yeah.
Do you remember we did the
Wild
show?
Wild Atlantic Way.
Yeah, the Wild Atlantic Way. And you
still
came along.
Still have a t-shirt.
I'll get your cap next time. But you came along, and I remember we were driving away from Clonakilty, and yourself and... co-stars?
Jennifer Barry. Please, Siobhan, my sister. Sorry, just had to.
Yeah,
shout
Jennifer
her out
Barry.
There.
She's. I just thought the two of you. I thought these two are firecrackers. Like, they're great fun. They're young. And here's my takeaway from both of you was that you both had. You're very, very positive people.
Yeah.
So given what you've been describing in the last 10 minutes about the heaviness in your world.
Yeah.
For you to have come through. I think with all that positivity,
yeah.
You know, like, I met you at the autumn launch then, and you were like a messer, you know, you're giddy. And I like that.
No,
to me, that's my gang. Like, then I heard you were going to be on Dancing with the Stars, and that was really clever casting because it's perfect for you. And is this something you're glad you did now, reflecting on your experience?
I'm so happy that I did. I wouldn't, everyone's like, would you ever change the way you got on this, or would you ever change the show? No, I like the path. I'm a firm believer that God knows what he's doing, and he's deciding for me up there.
He's guiding you along.
He's with my parents, like, with a script saying, well, Demi did the Young Offenders, you know, I'm going to give her Dance with the Stars. She's going to be on the Late Late Show. Very soon she'll be running the Late Late Show. And I'm like, oh, yeah.
Hey.
Oh, you see what I did
sorry,
there?
Sorry, is that on the agenda then?
Yeah, it probably is. I don't know what they're doing up there.
Just give me a few more years, would you? I'm not going anywhere yet.
I'm a firm believer in that, and... I wouldn't change it for the world. I'm super happy. And I got to meet so many fantastic people along the way. And I got to live with a fantastic woman, Cleona Hagen, and meet so many fans. I'm just super happy. Yeah. Like I said, head held high.
It's a positive experience all around, Kai. And you're now in a situation where you can relax a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. A lot more days off for me now. We'll still be doing the professional numbers on the weekend. But ultimately I'll probably be in and out of the studio helping Fred.
That was a dark number last night, wasn't it? The professional number. It was intense.
Very intense.
Chains
number.
And darkness and all sorts of carry on. But... I presume you all enjoyed yourself getting there.
Yeah, oh gosh, it's so much fun. You know, when you're dancing with these guys is a lot of fun with the celebs, but when you get to dance with your professional colleagues, it's really when you can kind of just go hell for leather and just really enjoy it. And Ian and Lilia, credit to them, doing all the choreography for the pro numbers. It's so great. And Darren thinking of concepts and all that. So
yeah, there was good stuff last night. Yeah, really good. Let's take some comments from our listeners on 51551. Eileen says, did Demi get to do her mocks? Wish her all the very best. My daughter and I voted for her every week. And you're doing the mocks in 4 weeks, is that it?
About 4 or 5 weeks, yeah.
Okay. Morning, says Alice in Dublin. Congratulations to Demi. Her dance this week was spectacular. How does she get voted off when her opponent falls? Is it not judged solely on the dance off? And best of luck with the exams. We'll keep going.
Brian said it last night in an interview. It's like he felt that his dancing in the dance off, even though he fell, was still better than ours. So that was kind of how he justified it. We haven't really spoke about it, really.
No, and a lot of people were like, well, he fell. Like, I wouldn't let that happen. I personally wouldn't have left if...
Remind people what happened. Just
so I danced first and I had a little stumble, but I didn't fall. I just kind of clashed and
tripped.
I just fell into Kyle's stomach small, but kept going and I had smiled, shouldn't have smiled. And then Fred went on afterwards and he...
fell to his knees.
Literally fell to his knees, yeah. It's like he slipped and then he lost balance and then he fell. And he got up super fast and he continued on. But I was happy that he got up and he kept going because I personally couldn't have done that. I probably would have stayed on the floor and cried.
Yes.
As a big baba, because it's embarrassing, right? But for him to get up so quickly and continue on with dance like nothing ever happened was fantastic. And he deserved to stay. He really deserved to stay. And I probably didn't tell you this. I was super happy. Like I said, I was super happy and proud of him for getting up and dancing on. I couldn't have done it. So for him to get through just shows that they see something in Fred. And
A lot of courage.
Okay,
so that's
brave.
good vibes all around. Mairead in Cork said, my daughter Emily is 7. Demi was her favourite. She bawled her eyes out when she got voted off.
Oh, stop.
Demi is a truly incredible girl, says Peter and Cavan. And Jay from Cork says, I'm annoyed over both Demi and Fred being in the dance-off. I think both the two former professional athletes are fine with the fitness, but both, I think, are very, very wooden. Demi and Fred have got the rhythm. So good luck to her in the Leaving Cert and in life. I'm listening to Debbie. She's an amazing, Demi, I should say. She's an amazing young lady. Her story resonates with me as I lost both my parents, my mum when I was 8 and my dad at 14. And the sadness doesn't go away ever, but it does get easier to deal with. And she sounds like a very together, confident, beautiful young woman. And I wish her the best of luck in her acting career and life in general. From Joanne, listening from Carlingford.
You.
Isn't that nice?
That was so nice.
So lots of love in the
a
house for you both this morning. Young Offenders back for more in the summertime for filming. Is that it? You're going to be working on that?
Yeah.
Exciting times.
I'm buzzing. Can't wait to be Linda. Whoop,
the good news is that, as well, after all of this, is that you've now become part and parcel of the TV world and landscape now. So we'll be seeing, you know, you're here now. You have arrived.
I've arrived.
And into our living rooms.
It was just about a matter of time.
Yeah, we got there.
Do you know what? Like I said, I could be on the Late Late Show again, am I right?
I would be shocked if you weren't. I'd be shocked if you weren't. No doubt about it. Demi and Kai, congratulations for what you've been doing on the TV the last number of Sundays, and you have every reason to walk tall into the future. Thank you both very much.
Thank you so much, Ryan.
All right, it's 18 minutes.
Thanks very much.
At 9:27, very excited about my next guest because he's written a terrific book that I think will be of great interest in this year of years. 100 years ago, recruitment started in England for the Black and Tans. And for 3 years, this crowd terrorised people all over Ireland. And now, 100 years later, they still cast this dark shadow over the country. And Dr. Tomás McNamara is a PhD, is an oral historian and heritage consultant, and he has collected stories about the Black and Tans in his book, The Time of the Tans, an oral history of the War of Independence in County Clare. And Tomás, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Ryan.
I think what strikes me about your story, before we get into the Black and Tans, is how young you were when you were bitten by the history bug and what you did with that with that wonderful contagion.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
It's difficult, Ryan. I was thinking about it on the way up, and it's actually very difficult to explain what draws you to history. You know, it's this feeling. You know, when I was a child, 12, 13 years of age, for whatever reason, I was pulled towards older things, older houses, older people in particular. And just was always enchanted with anything that could take me into the past. And certainly from the age of 12, 13, 14, I began to realise that older people were the optimal pathway towards that feeling of the past, towards that sense of the past. And I was really fortunate in the townland of Ballymalone, where I'm from, to have an older neighbour called Jim Mack, who, you know, was not able to read. He could barely write his own name. He never left the region of, you know, East Clare, maybe went into Limerick on the odd occasion, but will continue to be one of the wisest individuals I've ever encountered in my life. And that really instilled in me, you know, a number of things. One, that there was no necessary correlation between education and intelligence.
Yeah, you know, very good point.
It was an important, yeah. I think, learning in itself. But secondly, and more importantly, that there were people like Jim, you know, all across my own county of Clare and all across the country, and they had a tremendous value in their stories, in their memories, you know, in the words that they used, in the way that they spoke. And I really can't explain why, but I certainly know that from a very young age, I began to realise that value. And from about the age of 14, 15, I started to take down notes, you know, of old words that maybe I didn't understand. And then I'd venture a question and ask them to explain what the word meant. Sometimes they'd be Irish words that were mixed up in the English language.
Yeah.
And then increasingly, from about the age of 16, I think I started to take it a little bit more seriously, started to keep folklore journals, started to visit more older people in my community. And then at the age of 18, bought a dictaphone for the first time and went out starting recording voices. And ever since then, for the following 20 years, I've been increasingly intensive, you know, and committed to the notion of documenting that memory at a very broad level.
And what you call oral history is so important, but not just oral history, but written history and all history is fascinating on the basis that truth can die in history too.
For sure.
It's in the telling of the story, because there are two sides, but oftentimes only one. You say victors write the history and so on. So what do we do for veracity in history? How do you establish that?
Well, we try and complete the narrative, first of all. And I think if we're looking at any area of history, we're going to talk about the War of Independence in that period, you know, and there's been a fairly intensive focus on it for a lot of decades now. Mm. But is it complete? Is it total? And I would argue not. And ever since I was a young teenager documenting this memory, and particularly about the War of Independence, I saw a notable difference between what I was reading in books, you know, which was good in itself, but then what I was hearing at a local level. And I was hearing about the experience at a much broader level. Mm. You know, I was reading about IRA volunteers, you know, sometimes coming to man figures, major battles, ambushes. But in the townlands in our own County Clare and across the country, I was hearing about the experiences. So you can read about an ambush, you can get the statistical account, the number of dead, etc. But the actual emotion, the feeling of it, I wasn't getting. And that's critical, Ryan, because if we're trying to tell history, history is experience. So if somebody encounters the aftermath of an ambush or the burning of their home or whatever it might be, they're not thinking about themselves in a chronological sequence. They're thinking about the emotion and the feeling and the hurt and the pain of that. So to try and tell that history and get to the veracity of an overall narrative, then we have to go down the pathway of memory, or at least memory has to be part of the kind of mosaic of historical sources that we use to tell that overall story.
Sure. Well, for people whose history is a bit rusty from school and beyond, set us up for the War of Independence. How do we get to it? And just put your beginning of your book in context for us.
Sure. Well, I suppose, first of all, what needs to be understood is the War of Independence is part of a continuum in many ways. Mm-hmm. We know about the Easter Rising as seen as a sort of a starting point, but in actual fact, it's not, because in many cases, Republican tradition or Fenian tradition stretches much deeper back into history in local communities. And that's quite significant in terms of the support base that is developed in different areas based on the tradition that existed. But the Easter Rising, if we take it as a starting point, hugely significant landmark moment, but it's up in Dublin, right? It's a national event. And of course, there are attempts to take action in different parts of the country. 1917, we move into it. There's a gradual intensification of support. Tomás Ash from Kerry dies in September on hunger strike. The mindset of the nation dramatically changes then. Into 1918, we see more of a political development and consolidation of the Sinn Féin and separatist position. Then we move into January 1919. Dáil Éireann is declared. We know about the Salahead Beg ambush in County Tipperary, and the War of Independence kicks off.
Yeah.
And what's really significant then, Ryan, in the context of how the Black and Tans are introduced into Ireland, is that by the time March 1920 comes around, and the Black and Tans are introduced, the whole concept of separatism is firmly set in the consciousness of the Irish people. You know, they're a different mindset than they would have been 4 years ago. And then the British make the decision to insert this force into that milieu. And that is why I think one of the most significant reasons why they have had such an impact, because of the previous 3-4 years of kind of developing a real determination and mindset towards independence. And then suddenly this is the reaction of the British state.
Yes.
Which makes it quite a significant introduction.
So the Black and Tans arrived with kind of to coexist with other forces that were already here, isn't that right? With the RIC were there and there were other forces that were helping the British.
Exactly. Well, it started out, I suppose, between the IRA and the Royal Irish Constabulary, as the force, I suppose, charged with maintaining law in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And it became fairly apparent to the British state, I suppose, that either they were going to have to deal politically with acknowledging the demands for independence, or else, escalate their own side of the conflict. They decided to choose the latter, recruited throughout Britain, and very hastily recruited the force, who were predominantly ex-servicemen. There are many people quoted in the book, major, significant British military figures who call them thugs, who are terrorising the country.
Well, tell us a little bit about that, because 1919 is an interesting year, given that you've had 4 years of World War One, one of the greatest catastrophes in warfare in history. So they come out and they're kind of dispossessed, a lot of these soldiers. They've nowhere to go. Who are they and how are they formed? And why this constant... I mean, I've never heard one good word about the Black and Tan. So what happened? They're kind of demonic group of crazy Brits who come over here to bash the Irish and burn us out of our homes. There's your tabloid headline.
Yeah, well, that is the impression, certainly. And, none of that would have diluted, certainly, for the people I spoke to. I mean, I spoke to people over the age of 100, Ryan, many of them. And you could see in the body language the way they would change when the Black and Tans come up as part of the story. So they certainly created that sense of bitterness and enmity that went right across the generations in terms of memory. But they're ex-British servicemen who have been through the First World War. And if we're to try and pull ourselves back from it, I came from a townland that the Black and Tans raided on several occasions. Mm-hmm. I have the great same feelings. I grew up with the same feelings. But pulling ourselves back, they're ex-British servicemen. They've been through an awful lot of violence. They're unable to settle down into normal civilian life. And then an opportunity is presented to them to get a significant wage, to be sent into Ireland with very little discipline and to cause as much damage as was possible. And that was the loose directive. So I often see the Black and Tans as the edge of the axe head, but the person wielding the axe is the one more responsible. And the Black and Tans have gotten all of the hatred over generations because of what they did. But obviously they were sent into a situation by a system that empowered them and enabled them to do that.
And allowed them. Okay, so these guys arrive over. They're called Black and Tans, obviously, for sartorial reasons. Isn't that if they're...
Yeah, well, I mean, it's part of the... They were so hastily prepared that they didn't actually have uniforms for them. So they were part of the British military uniform, part of the RIC uniform, coloured in black and tan, a sort of a hybrid, appropriately enough, described as the Black and Tans.
And what would you describe was their agenda or their mission?
Well, their mission was to suppress the IRA and the Republican movement generally and to crush that.
By any means necessary, by the sounds of it.
By any means necessary. And what's significant really about that, Ryan, is the nature of the conflict was a very much a localised conflict. And that's really significant for memory because IRA units are set up according to the existing geographical and cultural boundaries. So you've men and women participating in the struggle for independence in their local place. So identity is brought into that, which is massive significance for memory and social and oral tradition. But the Black and Tans are sent into those areas. So you have a scenario, you mentioned the First World War, and we went through a learning period with that, where we knew that there were men left townlands and went off to France or other parts of the world to fight. You have now a scenario where British forces are coming into townlands. When I was 10 years of age, I found a revolver in my own townland in the ruins of an old cottage. You imagine the child I described earlier on finding that, the excitement of it. Yeah.
What year was the revolver from?
From the War of Independence, without a question, having worked in museums now. At the time, I was excited by an old gun.
Of course, of course.
But my point is this, that looking back on it, that really crystallises that notion that this was a war of national and international significance that was brought to my townland and townlands all across the country. So you had Black and Tan forces coming in, working usually with the RIC, who would have had the local knowledge.
Yeah.
Very ill-disciplined unit. ill-defined unit and let out to cause significant damage, which in some ways too, Ryan, it's worth mentioning that the conflict prior to that was a little bit more challenging in terms of the mindset of the Irish people, because you did have the IRA forces facing the RIC, who were predominantly Irish men, but now you had black and tans, who were predominantly English and Scottish men.
Yes,
and that in some ways it made the conflict easier. It certainly made it from the point of view of support. Even though it was more vicious, it was more violent, the IRA got more support subsequent to the Black and Tans introduction than they had before.
It was less like a civil war because you had British servicemen.
Forces, exactly.
Yeah, forces coming over to. In your book, you have people talking about, so these stories come alive through the oral histories, and you hear about them being very drunk. And the sense that there was a lot of them were criminals or lunatics, as to use the old words. But was that true? Did they empty out the prisons, or were they actually just people who'd returned from the front? Or?
Yeah, no. Again, it's down to the behaviour, Ryan. You know, if you imagine a rural place in Ireland or across in County Clare in 1919-20, and then you have people from cities coming into the area, you know, inflicting significant violence, drinking very heavily, the type of behaviour that they were that was characteristic of them, you know, would be very easily associated with lunatics and maybe people released from prisons.
Yes.
So I haven't found, or I think most historians haven't found, any hard evidence to show that they were released criminals. But the suggestion would be made in more than tongue in cheek that they certainly were criminals when they departed.
The Clare Journal reports, courtesy of your book, in April the 10th, in 1920, that all the able-bodied men in Scariff were told to line up, essentially, in the centre of the town. Mm-hmm. And what happened to them?
Well, they were horsewhipped in Scariff town. And I went further with that story. As you mentioned, that's taken from the Clare people at the time. But I actually spoke to people whose fathers were some of the men taken out.
Their shirts were removed and they were horsewhipped by...
by the British forces in Scariff. So you have a scenario there where, you know, you imagine the violence of that. Imagine what that does to the psyche.
The humiliation of it, the demoralisation of it, the anger that would... I mean, that image itself is a recruitment poster.
There's no question. And that does harden the attitudes. I spoke to a man, one man particularly, who was dragged out of his bed to be part of that group that were horsewhipped. And, you know, he was very emotional in telling the story because he's talking about his dad, you know, when his dad was in his 20s, and for that to happen to him. But for that to happen to the local community, is hugely significant. And, you know, there has been a lot of discussion and maybe revision about the War of Independence, but there's no question, certainly across hundreds of interviews that I've done, that there was significant support for the Republican movement. And, you know, incidents like that definitely hardened that support base, right? There's no question.
Houses being burned out, that's another common theme of the Black and Tans modus operandi. Talk to me a little bit about
that. Yeah, I mean, it's right across the county, and I actively went out to search for those stories because, you know, we have towns, and Balbriggan is a famous one, of course, and Cork were burnt. But in Clare, we had significant burnings following the Rinnean ambush. But you also had individual house burnings, and they endured long in the memory. You know, I spoke to one man, Paddy Gleeson, who was 106 when he passed away, and I interviewed Paddy over 10 years. And Paddy had a direct recollection of watching his neighbour's house being burnt by the auxiliaries and Black and Tans in December 1920. And he remembers, you know, the inhabitants of that house coming into his house being sheltered. He remembered going across when they had left to pull out a barrel of bacon, you know, which would have in rural Ireland was a significant thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But for Paddy, actually, and he was 105 telling me this, Ryan, I mean, he had tremendous pride. He was a 14, 15-year-old boy at the time, but he had so much pride in the fact that he went over and rescued the barrel of bacon, you know, that was his connection to that moment. But even, I think one of the most beautiful things, he said, you know, the wind was blowing towards Tumgraney, and that was it. That was the final thing he said on the tape. Yeah. And that level of detail, there's no historical significance. But what it is, for me, for somebody who wants to reconnect people to the history, that takes you to the moment.
Yeah, it does,
more
yeah.
so than just a detail of a date or, you know, who was responsible. That brings you closer to the experience, to the feeling of that time, which has always been part of my aim.
You did a bit of work on Who Do You Think You Are with Samantha Power.
That's
Samantha
right.
Power is a great episode. I enjoyed it thoroughly. And, you know, I often, obviously not, I did that programme once upon a time, but I remember as you're describing that, the wind blowing, sitting in Carrow Row in an old school where my great grandparents, who I would never have known, were teachers, and incidents that had happened to them. And just like you described that man whose father was dragged out and bullied by the... family history and the connection is when you're confronted with the story, whether it's a letter or even an anecdotal story from an older relative, can be really powerful and can move you in a way it kind of shouldn't, because you feel you should be moved only by stories that relate to people you've met and know. But if the history is good enough and well told enough and strong enough, it can actually make you emotionally time travel.
Well, there's something hugely significant in that. And you think about people and their landscape around them, you know, young people particularly. You know, if somebody's driving through a local place, they should be able to read that landscape. You know, they should be able to know what happened in that place.
Every wall, every
the
turn of blade of grass. Yes,
there's no question. And I really think that is a much more powerful way of engaging people with history. When we talk about the French Revolution or the American War of Independence to a 15-year-old, they may become engaged. But if you can say, you know, let's talk about the War of Independence and point to a spot on the road where something happened, where they walk on a daily basis and maybe sometimes connected through to their family history and tradition. But I just want to make one point, Ryan, if I've time. You mentioned about family tradition. One of the more powerful stories I encountered was interviewing a man. First of all, I met him on a plane on the way to Milwaukee.
Where you're always going to get a good story.
Well, absolutely.
Short,
well, the thing about this is you're going to get these stories anywhere, because if you have that capacity to engage people,
if you're interested,
the stories are there.
Okay.
But I followed up and interviewed him. But in April 1965, he's in Ennisheim Hospital with his mother, who's passing away. She's in her second day of a coma, and he knows she's dying. On the second day of the coma, she manages to move in the bed, and naturally, his first feeling is she's coming around. She manages to lift herself up enough. She pulls the rosary beads from behind her, where they'd been hanging for about 2 weeks. She kisses the crucifix. She looks to the foot of the bed and she says, "Francie, Francie, Francie." She lies back down. She goes back into a coma. And as my interviewee said, Flan said, the following day she fell asleep forever. Now, that's April 1965. 46 years earlier, her 15-year-old brother, Francie Murphy, was shot dead, allegedly by British forces, in August 1919 in her home in Lann. She ran down, held him as he died. And for 46 years, Ryan, she didn't speak about him. But the last three words on this earth were, "Francie, Francie, Francie."
That's a stunning story.
Well, what it, for me, illustrates is how important silence is when you're exploring memory.
Yes.
Because some of the more powerful stories linger in silence. But if you can, you know, be patient enough and persevere enough, you can develop or engineer these moments of disclosure that are really powerful.
All your stories referring to people, older people of a certain vintage, backs up a thesis of mine, which is that we in this country should have a relationship with older people. That is, we need to redefine how we treat older people and how we respect them. And that's not meant to be patronising. It's meant that, I keep using this example. I remember being in New Orleans, and I went to the local, the tourist office, and there was nobody working behind the counter under 80. No one. They were all 80 plus. Yeah. And do you know why? Because they know everything. And they were respected. And you just said to them, "Excuse me." And, you know, these people wanted to be there, probably weren't being paid, maybe a cup of coffee and lunch and thanks very much. But that's, if they want to be there, let them be there, because they are repositories of stories and history and memory.
But the funny thing is that was always, throughout ancient Ireland, that was always the way. We valued our elders in our society in the past. But for some reason, in more recent times, you know, it seems to be, you know, when you're not economically productive, you kind of become a bit marginalised. I believe fully in what you're saying, because for over 20 years now at a wide range of levels, I've tried to shine a light and illuminate the value of older people. Good. And they are, you know, of tremendous value to us, not just in terms of historical knowledge like this, but in the general way of life. Go back to my neighbour Jim, couldn't read, couldn't write, was incredibly instructive to me, you know, across such a range of subjects and just ways of life. Yeah. You know, if I just wanted to chat about something, I was a bit low after a hurling match. Yeah. You know, he'd find some way of...
Or
of
turn
some,
a phrase or
turn
something.
Turn a phrase that just make you see things that little bit differently.
Let's take some texts. Recall a story, says Mike in Galway. My late grand uncle recounted to me of the Rinnean ambush in West Clare. I'm sure you're well familiar with that. He witnessed an IRA man who had caught a fleeing auxiliary officer. The officer was running up a hill and surrendered, but was swiftly dispatched by the IRA man. And following this, Lahinch had a number of homes burnt down. And an interesting follow-up is that it seems the men who were involved in the ambush themselves had tragic deaths, and some say due to what they had done. My father was from Milltown Malbay, a psychiatric nurse in England in World War II, who nursed former tans, which is the awful irony. Another from Mary in Castlebar says that my grandfather in Wicklow was forced out of his sickbed to help remove a huge tree knocked down by the IRA to prevent them progressing further down the road. And Frank says, while it's undeniable that many tans behaved badly in Ireland, there are also examples of good behaviour. In my hometown of Newcastle West, a tan joined a respected member of the community to deliver Christmas presents to children in the poorest part of the town in late December 1920.
Yeah, there's just a couple of things to say on that, which I think is that's perfectly in line with the types of tradition. The last point about the humanity, and it does come up, Ryan, you know, I think sometimes we want to gravitate towards humanity. My grandmother, when her house was raided, would always talk about the one black and tan that tried to reassure her, not the eight or nine that smashed the house up. There was one who tried to, you know, just to kind of make her feel a bit better and say, look, things will be all right. They'll let them do what they're doing and they'll go. So I think sometimes people like to gravitate there, which is a good thing. It's about human beings.
Let me ask you, sorry for cutting, but I do want to ask you, time is slightly against us, but there's so much in your book that, that intrigues. What happened to female informers at this time? What class of punishment would they would have conferred upon them?
Yeah, I mean, it was a significant point because, you know, in a war like that, which is so, intelligence is so central to it, you know, for somebody to actually give information away was quite significant for the Republican movement. So there were most cases, you know, I have found, and it would be across the country as well, tar would be put in women's hair, their hair might be cut to the bone. There was one case where a pig ring was inserted into a woman's buttocks in order to punish her for allegedly giving information to the British forces.
And this is where she was told, go down to the police station to get that removed.
Go down to the RIC and get them to take it out. Yeah exactly. So, but it gives you the sense, I suppose, Ryan, of the violence of it. And across that book, there's stories of humour, of poignancy, of bravery and of sadness. But it was a really violent, volatile time, which we can't forget.
Okay, we'll give the last word to the parting shot by the Black and Tans as they began to board lorries, taking them back to Dublin in February the 1st, 1922. I'm going to go to Ennis Timon, and there they are being pushed onto the vans and being told, slán a bhaile, as it were. What happened then?
Yeah, the crowd assembled, I think, to, as you say, to say slán a bhaile, and to go back to your contributor there, your texter, about the Rinnean ambush, that was a kind of key landmark in that area. So young school children were heard shouting up the IRA and up Rinnean particularly, and one British soldier seemed to have taken serious offence to that. Opened up a hand grenade, threw it into the crowd and significantly damaged a massive amount of people. But maybe an appropriate bit of finish is that about an hour after that, Nora Canavan, she was 104 when I interviewed her, and she remembered sitting outside her home watching those lorries depart below her house, where she had seen them daily for about 2 years and knew that they were leaving for the last time. And even when I recorded her, you could feel it in her voice and in her breathing, the sense of relief that they were passing her home for the last time, which was a great moment in that sense.
It's another reason to tout the story about the necessity to have history being brought back to the junior certificate, as I'm sure you're a great believer in that. Your book should be in every school library around the country. So congratulations on that. You've put an awful lot of effort into a lot of time, a lot of emotion, but great academic endeavour. So well done, Tomás. Best luck with it.
I
hope it goes really well for you. The Time of the Tans, it's an oral history of the War of Independence, County Clare, written by Tomás McNamara, who joined us live in studio this morning. Appreciate your time today. It's 8 minutes to ten. 9:21 this Thursday morning. Blind Boy Book Club, very good morning to you.
How are you, Ryan? What's the crack?
How's the world?
It's not too bad. It's a bit grey at the moment. Well, I suppose, Limerick is a bit grey, so I can only assume that the rest of the world is also grey. A
little bit like that. I'm just curious as to how you are, because I know you're a little unwell, and I suspect that's from doing or trying to do 5 billion things at the same time. You're a busy guy, your head is bursting with ideas.
I'm grand now, but what am I doing? I've got my weekly podcast, I'm writing my second book, I've got a series on BBC, and then I'm also trying to do kind of a video streaming thing as well. So,
and your tour.
Oh yeah, my tour as well. Yeah, and I'm touring all over the place, so I'm doing 4 or 5 gigs a month. But look, that's just the way I am. That's the way it has to be. People are always asking me, why am I so busy? Why do I have so many things on? And the way I look at it is that if you're doing 5 things, you can be guaranteed that 2 of them are going to fail. So you have to do 5 things, you know?
What about sleep? Are you good at sleep?
I do sleep, but I don't really enjoy sleeping. I'm well able to sleep, but if I could not sleep, I would happily not sleep. I find it really boring to just lie down for 8 hours. Do you know what I mean?
I'd be on the same page in the sense that sometimes I find myself going, I wish I could just press a button that said off and then not that waste of, as you say, time, because there's so much to do.
So much to do, but as well, whatever it is about me, I always get creative ideas at about 11 o'clock at night. So I find myself in the studio doing a song or writing at 11 o'clock and then staying up till 5. But then I also want to get up early as well then to, do you know what I mean?
I do, but it just leaves very little time for that bit where the body has to actually stop.
Yeah, and but the thing is too, like, the reason I do sleep is because sleep is utterly essential, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, they even did studies on, they were looking at people who had little cuts on their hands. So they had two subjects, and one person had a little cut and the other person had a little cut. And the person who didn't get sleep, the cut on their hand took like a week later to heal. So when you look at it from that perspective, then I go, right, okay, I definitely need to get minimum 7 hours of sleep a night.
And when the doctor said to you recently, right, throat infection, here's antibiotics, you're run down, what do you do? Do you say, okay, I'm going to respond to that, or do you just keep going?
Well, I was also, I think the problem was, I'd gotten two or three like sore throats in a row, and I usually don't get that. I was running 10 kilometres 3 times a week, because I love running. I run for my head and for... Running for me is it's therapeutic. So I just said, right, there's no need to actually run 10 kilometres. That's a bit excessive. So I cut it back to 7 kilometres and now I'm fine.
And now that kind of keeps your, what, head clear?
It keeps my head clear, but as well, it's, you know, it was winter time. And I heard a theory as well that we had a particularly warm winter as a result of global warming. I heard that there was more germs around because... In the winter, the cold actually kills germs, and when the weather is slightly warmer, we're able to catch more of them. Now, I heard that in a pub, so don't quote me on it.
Well, no, I definitely won't coach on that one, because generally you've done your homework. But when you just talk about sleep there, you've podcasting and you're thinking and you're writing it all the time. The phone, gadgets, devices, are they gone from the bedroom?
Oh, for me? Mm. Oh, yes, yes, yes.
It's critical, isn't it?
Well, here's the thing. So I used to get 8 hours, like about 6 years ago, I used to get 8 hours of sleep, not a bother. And then I started to notice I'm getting 6 hours of sleep. Mm. It's when I got a smartphone for the first time.
Yep.
When I didn't have a smartphone, when I used to just have an old Nokia, my phone was just for text messages, and then I'd read a book before I went to sleep. So one thing I have definitely noticed, and what I did start doing, I bought myself an alarm clock. And now the phone is on the other side of the room. So I read books in bed. Now, the glare of the screen, like even if you go to sleep and you wake up at 4 a.m. and you just look at the time on your phone, the blast of blue light into your face is enough to kick your brain back into gear and wake you. So that's out of my life now. I bought a really simple little clock. And what it does as well, it's fancy. It projects the time using a laser onto the ceiling, which is pretty cool.
That's the high end of the clock.
It's not really. It was like 20 quid, like, but
yeah,
you know.
But that's high end.
It's nice and futuristic.
You talked in January, only the last month really, I suppose, about the stress of bereavement. And we've been talking about it quite a lot this week with regards to a woman who wrote in to say that, she felt that people are uncomfortable around the language of death. And you were talking about your father.
Yeah.
Tell me about that, will you?
Well, like, having a kind of healthy attitude to bereavement would be, that's an integral part of my mental health process, you know? So I did a podcast about 6 months back about, like, my dad died when I was about 20, you know? And it's, I'd be atheistic. Not atheistic. I suppose I would be. I don't believe in a God. God doesn't exist in my life. The afterlife is not something that exists in my life. I would view life as being very organic. You know, you have your time on the earth, and once that's gone, that's it. Mm-hmm. So when you're like that in particular, it can be difficult to process bereavement. And for me, what I do, and I did a full podcast on this, I look at... loss and bereavement. Like, first off, life contains inevitable pain, okay? That is the human condition. Suffering is guaranteed. We can't avoid suffering. What we can do is we can look at our attitude towards suffering.
And manage it.
And manage it. Mm. And the thing with bereavement is, even though it's incredibly painful, you can get great personal meaning. That the loss of a very close person in your life, as devastating as it is, can shape who you become. And the thing is too, even though I don't believe in someone's spirit, we'll say, carrying on after they're dead, what does happen is aspects of that person's personality, their beliefs, their ideals, their body mannerisms, these things do live on in the people who were connected with the bereaved, you know?
Yep.
So that's, I just did a full podcast on that. That's my personal way of dealing with death. And I think it's a healthy way of processing it.
It's like sometimes when I see if somebody dies young and they have children, I often think that that person, it kind of lives on in a manner of speaking through the child. Would that be an element
Absolutely.
Of that about it? Yeah.
But I mean, death, you can't avoid death. You can't avoid suffering. Suffering and death they're part and parcel of the joy of being alive. Being alive is a wonderful thing. You can have great times, but you can't have that without the inevitability of death and suffering. And every person on the planet at one point in their life is going to have a devastating, horrible moment in their life, and this is a guarantee, this is a given of existence. So I can appreciate why people are uncomfortable about talking about death. I mean, a lot of just simply being alive is trying to avoid the reality of everything you meet, everything you love, everyone you love, every dog you rub, they will all die eventually, including ourselves. And we don't like to think about that.
Yeah.
But regarding Irish culture and death, I think around death, Irish people are actually quite healthy. Now, we're losing it a bit. I mean, if you look at cultures that like truly confront death, right? If you look at cultures that really confront death and embrace it. In Tibet, for instance, there's Buddhist monks in Tibet. And in this particular part of Tibet, they don't have soil. It's rocky mountains, you know, and freezing cold. Mm-hmm. So they can't bury their dead. So what they actually do is a thing called a Tibetan sky burial, where they leave the bereaved corpse on a mountain and vultures pick at it and scatter the bones over a valley. So you have these entire valleys with rotting human corpses, right? But then the Buddhist monks, young Buddhist monks, they go down to the valley of rotting corpses and they meditate for hours while being surrounded by rotting humans. Now, that might sound absurd, but that's the Buddhist way of going, death is inevitable. I cannot spend my day pretending it doesn't exist, so I will meditate in front of a corpse. There's also a tradition within Christianity. There's nuns in France in, I think it was the 18th century, in a certain monastery. They would also meditate. When an older nun died, they would sit her corpse on like a throne, and the body would be in open display and it would decompose. And other nuns would come there to pray and be around death. And if you look at Irish cultural traditions, now it's something we're kind of, that's disappearing now.
The wake.
The wake, the traditional Irish wake.
Sitting around a corpse.
But even more so than that, you go rural maybe 100 years ago, they weren't just sitting around with the corpse. They were dragging the corpse out of the coffin and shoving whiskey down its throat and having a party with an actual corpse. And again, this seems incredibly absurd to us today in 2019,
yes,
where death is completely sanitized.
Yes.
Like even, I think it might be British people, they can't deal with the fact that we have open caskets.
And they also have a much longer period, don't they, before burial?
It
goes on for ages. We tend to kind of done and physically, literally dusted within a week.
Well, I mean, if you're going to be drinking whiskey with the corpse, it might be sensible to do it within 28.
Get down to business, yeah.
Yeah,
I hear you. Do you know what the other thing, when I speak to people, and we've been talking about a lot the last couple of weeks, and I do think it's healthy. People might say that's all very bleak, but actually, it's only as bleak as you make it, and if it remains taboo if you don't talk about it. That's why I don't mind chatting away with you about it. And one of the things, a response to death from people who loved the person who died is anger.
Yeah.
A lot of anger, which dissipates with time, but initially for a year, maybe two, a ferocity in the emotions.
I mean, look, death is complex, and it can, you know, it can cause us to reflect on ourselves. And like, anger is a part of the bereavement process, and that anger can be an irrational anger at the person who has died. Because the thing is, with intense emotions, it can take us back to being children, essentially. You know, when you're very emotionally intense, you can go back to being a child. Mm. And we can have this unconscious anger towards the person who died for abandoning us, even though that doesn't make rational sense. That's where the person is at that time. The anger can also be anger at yourself, because maybe you didn't spend enough time with the person who died.
Yep.
Or maybe anger at yourself for... maybe you had a resentment towards them when they died and you never resolved it. You know, all these, the complexities of human relationships, which are black and white, you know, dark and light, when someone's taken all of a sudden death. I mean, the way, the blanket kind of statement about bereavement is that everyone's bereavement is unique to them, right? It's the bereavement that you experience will be as unique to you as the relationship you had with the person who died. Mm. And that's the only way to look at it.
Yep.
And... like, when my dad died, one of I spent a lot of time at the start stressing over whether I'm doing bereavement right. I would get anxiety over whether I was crying enough. Things like that, you know.
How did he die, can I ask you?
He got a brain tumour. And he died, like, within 6 weeks. Just right. Very sudden, you know, short illness.
Yes.
And I was very young, you know, and... for me, that was like a moment where that was, I had to become a man at that moment, you know. That immediately took me from childhood to, I am now definitely a man and I must stand on my own 2 feet. So I actually take a great kind of a strength from his death, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Because that shaped me into being who I am now.
You, talking to you, and I've met you several times on air and off, there's a few people that strike me as speaking a certain language. I put Tommy Tiernan in there. I put Michael Harding in there. A populist, philosophy, if you want, philosophy you want to call it. When we first met, it would have been very much Rubber Bandits.
Yeah.
Funny, a lot of comedy. But then you drifted into, while you do both, this idea of, you know, your podcast is touching nearly a million listeners around the world. People want to listen to you ruminate about the things like you're talking about this morning. Where did that come from? That as I say, that drift from just comedy to reflections and ruminations.
What kind of drives it, to be honest, is the nature of where the internet has gone, right?
Right. Yeah.
So, like, first and foremost, like, I'm an artist, so even like the Rubber Bandits comedy stuff, even though it on the surface can appear silly. In order to be able to create anything, you need to be able to truly ruminate and analyse whatever it is you're looking at.
Mm.
So the thing with the internet in 2019, you have to be able to churn out content continually.
Yeah.
You can't just have one or two videos every year. That was fine in 2010. So just the very nature of... my podcast is essentially like my sketchbook. So when I sit down to write my actual book, my short stories, which is... that's art, essentially. That's making a piece of art or a Rubber Bandit song. I have a sketchbook of ideas and ruminations that go into the creation of this work. But my podcast is every week just laying bare. This is my sketchbook. These are the things I'm thinking about. These are what I'm analysing. And it's like everything I speak about on the... like, I'm writing my book daily. So everything I speak about on my podcast is almost like... the little bits of the sketchbook and the thoughts that will turn into a short story, turn into a piece of fiction.
And the podcast is just touching, I think, generationally, and almost, it's just a lot of men. I mean, obviously it's men and women, but I just get the sense that you seem to be talking a language for people. You mentioned on the Late Late Show, never forget it, that idea that people of your generation are throwing themselves into rivers. That was the quote.
Yeah.
And just, God, it was like a moment. It touched a chord and people went, he's right. Why aren't we talking about this? And it just felt almost cathartic. It was like a relief. Somebody has mentioned the unmentionable. Somebody has shone a torch into the corner.
Well, with the podcast, again, it's like I started the podcast because so many people asked me to do one, especially after that moment on the Late Late and people started to listen to what I was saying. outside of comedy will say. They were like, you should do a podcast. So I did for the crack.
Mm.
And it's interesting. It did start off with young men being the listeners, but now I can't even pin down my listenership. It's the gender is kind of balanced. The age is balanced. Like, I do get lovely messages from people. Like, I did a live podcast in Killarney there a few weeks ago, and a lady who was, she must have been in her 60s, come up to me and she said, your podcast has caused me to have a relationship with my brother that I never had. So this woman was in her 60s and she had a brother who she never really connected with or spoke to, and my podcast is what caused them now to have a proper brother-sister relationship.
And how does that make you feel?
It's humbling, but as well, it freaks me out a little bit. I mean, when I do that podcast, that's I have my own little home studio, which essentially, it's a soundproof bedroom, and I have a sock over my microphone. And it's just me ruminating to myself. And when I actually think, Jesus, there's a million people listening to this all over the world, I have to be careful with that, because that can... That's freaky, you know?
But, when your mother went into the butcher's recently...
How'd you find out about that?
I hear stuff. And she goes into the butcher. Now, you'd think the butcher boy would be sitting there, and I'm being casually stereotyping, as I suggest that the butcher would be sitting there with the meat. But what happened?
I forgot I told you that. My ma's actually listening now at the moment.
Good.
So there was this, I've recently gone kind of vegan, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was concerned about the environment, and I was looking at how we all need to cut down on the meat that we're eating to help the environment. So I now am plant-based 6 days a week.
Okay.
But on a Sunday, I'm eating meat.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a butcher's in Limerick, and they basically started sending me private messages on Instagram of steaks because they heard that I was going vegan, you know. So I found this hilarious. And they're fantastic butchers. It's Garrett's down in Limerick. But
yeah.
I went in there anyway, and I was bringing my mother with me because I was telling her, geez, this butcher's is lovely. It's a really, really good butcher's. So she goes in, I leave. And then she couldn't resist it. And she went up to the butcher and said that lad there was actually blind by. And then the butcher starts hugging her and kissing her. And telling her he's a massive fan of the podcast and all of this, so that was lovely. My ma gets a kick out of that stuff, you know. I'm not too interested in that.
You went in without the bag over your, the plastic bag
obviously,
over your head,
yeah.
Obviously. And you're wearing it now as we speak.
Of course.
And you're vaping?
I'm vaping water, Ryan. I'm not. You're not allowed vape inside in studios, you see. So what I have is I've got a vape pen and there's only water in it. So it's a stage vaping pen. So I'm not actually violating any laws.
I appreciate that. But even if as you're in a studio on your own, you're I can hear it there now, and you've got the bag over your head, which I can hear as well as you're speaking. You arguably could go into that studio not wearing the bag over your head because no one necessarily is going to see you.
I know, but like, I'd be meeting people at the door. I'd be doing all of this. I mean, the thing with me and the plastic bag, it's a way to have my face continually pixelated. Like I've said it many times on the podcast, people say to me, why do you wear a bag? The simple reason is I've got a podcast with a huge amount of listeners. I'm on the television. I want to just live a regular, normal life in Limerick City. I want to not be interrupted, I want to go to the shop, to go to the pub and just live my life as a normal person. No different to like Podge and Raj, except instead of a puppet, I just have a bag.
Do you think this would be a very different conversation if you didn't have the bag on your head? In other words, would you feel exposed and talk to me with a different voice?
No, this is my real,
Is this as real as get? You don't suddenly take the bag off and, you know, you're speaking with a Rex Harrison accent.
No. Yeah. The thing is, over the years, the earlier, like when I'm doing like Rubber Bandit stuff on TV,
mm-hmm.
comedy written stuff, that's me in a different character. That's more absurd. But when I'm doing the podcast, like, it's just me.
Let's take a flavour of some of the texts coming in about you this morning. Blind Boy's words, says the text, are resonating profoundly with me this morning. My dad always told me to stand on my own two feet, and I never knew what that meant until he died. I was older when he died, but that's when I became a woman, and I appreciate Blind Boy's thoughtfulness and honesty. Eileen says, Blind Boy is so right about death being sanitised. We can't even say someone died or is dead. That awful Americanism, passed or passed away, is now common parlance, and it drives me crazy. It's okay to say dead. Blind Boy's podcast, meanwhile, are my company on my daily runs. And they make me so much, they make them, I should say, so much more pleasant. Elizabeth says, I'm a woman in my 50s and blind boy, I love your podcast. Keep them coming. Now here's the mammy in me. Cut back on the vape. couldn't resist. She couldn't resist. One more from Teresa. All women, as it happens this morning on the text. My blind boy is so insightful and refreshing in his straightforward honesty. Pain is the flip side of love and living. Grief cracks you open and joy at everyday life finally arrives after the tsunami of all emotions. What is he reading at the moment, or any top recommendations reading wise? Any good books beside the bed now that you're not on your phone?
What's the most recent book I was reading? I read a book called A Short History of Drunkenness, which is the history of alcohol, which was quite interesting.
Well, I'd say it was fascinating.
It was very, very fascinating, yeah.
You have, like, that's the thing with you, as when I'm in conversation with you on or off, is that you're never bored necessarily, I'd say,
no,
by a conversation. It's always going to lead potentially you somewhere, and you ask then, well, where'd you hear that? Or is that it? Like, it's a constant curiosity.
I'm very lucky in that respect, is in that I'm passionate and curious, mm-hmm, about a lot of things. I never lost the childhood curiosity. That's something that I've managed to hold on to, and I'm very lucky, because if you are an artist and you're creative, that's the most important thing. If you are to be a person who's creating anything, you need to, everything starts from asking questions about everything. Like, even here, like, I'm down here in RTE Studios in Limerick, mm-hmm, but even before I went on air, I was all over the room looking at cameras and equipment and Googling them, and I can't stop just wanting to learn about absolutely everything. And that daily kind of little moments of passion are what turn into creative ideas.
Yeah, your day is your palate for that evening's conversation.
So the only thing I'm not that interested in is sport. I just don't have that gift. I don't have the gift of understanding sport. But outside of that, I'm interested and passionate about absolutely everything. And I got to say, it's good crack being able to live like that.
One thing I'd say about the sport thing, I'd probably share that a little bit in that, is that you can appreciate the passion.
I admire it and I envy it.
Yeah, exactly.
I am envious of, here's this thing that I watch other people care about it so much, but I've tried. I just don't have access to it. I don't know what it is. I don't have access to that.
That gene or that.
Yeah, yeah. But I respect it. I totally respect it. I see how much meaning it gives people and I admire that, but it's, I just don't get it.
You're on the road with a tour. What? How does the show work on stage? I'd be curious to see you in Vicar Street. So what's the? Well, you're sold out on March 4th, but you're back in April 6th and 7th. But you're all around the country. How's it working for you? Enjoying it?
Yeah, it's fantastic. What I do is I don't announce who the guest is going to be. Mm-hmm. I often ask Twitter, like, if I go to, like, I'm going to be down in Cork now as well in.
April 27th, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm going to say to Twitter, who would you like me to have as a guest? And my audience then makes suggestions, and based on my audience suggestion, then I ask the guest. And then I'll ask Twitter, what should I ask the guest? So I really democratise the process, and it takes away bias for me. But what I try and do with the live podcast, I could talk to the person for maybe 2 hours, and what I'm aiming for is not an interview, but an actual conversation.
Yeah.
That's what I want. It's, even though I could have, we'll say, a university lecturer whose their main expertise is astrophysics, I would like to have that person talk about cakes.
Yeah.
Do you know, that's good conversation. And what we try and achieve with the live podcast is to create an intimacy in the venue where everybody, and we get it every time, everyone's truly listening and we all feel part of this conversation. And at the end, questions can be asked. And I've had some really amazing, I think the best podcasts, or the best live podcast interview I've had so far would have been Bernadette Devlin McCalliskey.
Yeah, fascinating woman.
Yeah, and it was fantastic. I had her up in Ulster Hall to hear her speak for 2 hours, and a pin could have dropped in the room, and it happened to be at the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Marches in Ireland. And she had an opportunity there, and she said it to me afterwards, to speak in a way that she hasn't had. She, like, when she would have been brought on to current affairs programs, mm-hmm, she'd get a small chance to speak, and then someone else is brought in who disagrees with her, and she'd never really been given an opportunity to just speak, to just talk and have a conversation. So it was a real privilege to be able to do that. I had great crack with Spike Lee. I had an opportunity to interview Spike Lee.
Didn't you talk about Daniel O'Connell with him? And
yeah, I spoke with Spike Lee about Daniel O'Connell and his relationship with the abolitionist,
yes,
Frederick Douglass.
Yeah, fascinating man.
And I stayed in contact with Spike and we email each other. I'm trying to... Limerick... Frederick Douglass, who's the great abolitionist, he visited Limerick at a speaking tour. Daniel O'Connell brought him to Limerick in the 1800s. So I'm trying to get Limerick to recognise that with a plaque, and I'm in contact with Spike about that. If I could get Spike to come to Limerick to unveil a plaque of Daniel O'Connell, or sorry, Frederick Douglass, that would be incredible.
Wonderful. I like the sound of that entirely. We have to leave it there for now, but it's always really good to talk to you, Blind Boy. A text came in to say, I believe Blind Boy is saving my son's life. It's a massive thing to say. He listens to his podcast all day. And another says, not understanding sport makes you normal. So we'll leave it at that for now. It's good to talk to you. Hope all goes well with you on your tour, and hopefully catch up with you at some stage along the way.
Nice one. Thanks very much,
as
Ryan.
Always, mind yourself. Blind Boy Boat Club joining us live from our Limerick studios this morning. Always good to talk to him. Rock a sense, I think, and intriguing. And the podcasts are fascinating too. 28 minutes past nine, it's Friday morning, and I'd like to introduce you to Lauren Gaffney. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning, Ryan.
You are somebody with a story. You'd introduced yourself this morning to me just as you sat down as a bit of a chancer. So from one to another, tell me about your J1 in Boston and its association with music.
Yeah, so I was doing a J1 in Boston. And I had a few songs written before I went over, but I was living in this frat house. It was a bit mad. There was mice everywhere. But the reason why I wanted to stay there was because they had a piano, like a big piano. I was like, here, I can write music all the time.
Yeah.
So I went over, and in the mornings I used to get up and write music on this out-of-tune grand piano. But I was like, a real grand piano. I was in love. Like, so I ended up writing music for this musical that I wrote called Big Shot.
And that was how many years ago?
So 5 years ago now. Yeah, 5 years ago I started writing it.
And what is Big Shot?
So it's basically this original musical that I wrote about this lawyer who has never lost a case. He's from New York. And he meets this Irish girl in the coffee shop every day. He ends up falling in love with her. And he's like, okay, I have to tell this girl that I love her. And she goes over there to like become an artist. So like she's a bit of a story as well. But when he goes to finally tell her that he loves her, he finds out that she's actually engaged to his client who's guilty of murder.
She is.
She's engaged. So he has to, he doesn't know what to do because he wants to tell her that he loves her. And then he finds out she's engaged to this murderer. So he doesn't know whether to follow like client confidentiality and, you know, not tell anyone.
Good story.
Yeah. So
good story. Where did that come from?
Dilemma.
Did you get that out of, just pluck that out of the sky?
Yeah,
or
I just
did
started
you?
Writing songs and then I was like, oh, this is for a lawyer. This is for an Irish girl. I don't know, to be honest. Just kept flowing out of me.
And it's a New York story.
Yeah. It's based in New York.
Okay.
Yeah.
And New York is, you know, I love New York. And every time, it's like when you drive into New York, it's like arriving on a movie set.
I know.
So I can see why you'd set it there.
Yeah, I love it there. Well, Broadway's there too. So I was like, I'll set it where I want it to be.
I remember going for on Broadway to a restaurant where there's a lot of people who want to be on Broadway are working.
Oh, yeah.
What's it called? Is it called Star Diner?
I think it's called the Star Diner.
Where they all want to
Stardust Diner.
We'll find out.
Something like
and
that.
And they're singing and they're amazing singers.
Yeah, I know that place.
Do you know
unbelievable.
That?
Yeah.
I've never had a burger like it.
I know, you get entertained for days in there and get to have nice food
But it comes back to your trip there and can see why you'd be taken in, especially. Do you have a background in musical theatre?
I always loved musicals from when I was a child. Like when I was raised by my parents, my mom used to work on weekends and my dad would put me in front of the TV and like show me Annie and Oliver, all the videos and Grease, and just show me all the musicals. And I was like, oh my goodness, I used to sing. Apparently I was singing like Annie before I could talk.
Right.
Everyone says that, don't they?
No, but it's nice. But they're great. Musicals are great because there's a little lesson in there.
I think there's
the colour and the razzmatazz.
And just the people you meet doing musicals. Like you meet musicians, obviously, like amazing musicians. Then you meet talented dancers, actors, singers, choreographers, directors, like the amount of people I've met because of the show is crazy. Yeah.
And
I'm so blessed.
They're everywhere in Ireland. I'm intrigued by that musical theatre people everywhere.
And they're brilliant. And
they're
so fun. They're great crack.
And Ellen Stardust Diner.
That's Stardust.
What a spot. If anyone's going there, except you have to queue, you have to join the line.
Yeah,
for about
join the
half
line.
An hour,
yeah, you have to wait around the corner.
Now, back to you. So there you are in a J1, grand piano, 5 years ago. You've got mice, you've got a piano, and you've got a head full of ideas.
Yeah.
What do you do with this musical then? When you've did you complete writing this?
Yeah. So I said, how can I make this part of my degree? So I went home, asked DCU, could I put it on there? And they let me. And then we sold out the first night. Then we moved to Pat's. You know, Pat's part of DCU now. Yeah. And we sold out there too. Then after college, I was like, okay, I need to keep going with this.
And was your degree in what?
Music and human development.
And you made your musical part of the degree, of your thesis.
Yeah, exactly.
What a great idea. So you were kind of
tried.
Chancing your arm,
exactly.
If I may, by using what yeah. you had in front of you to yeah. And that you could incorporate that.
Yeah, exactly.
And it went well.
Yeah, then we ended up going to San Diego and Mexico.
With the musical.
Yeah, we won the Spirit of Fringe Award over there. Damn. Yeah, it was crazy. We did 7 nights in the Lyceum Theatre. Then a year later, brought it to London, to Camden. Then I was like, okay, I need to take a break from this because I gave it so much. Like, I just imagine. Gave it every cent I had. And like, I'd rewritten it and rewritten it. So I took a 2-year break. And then a few months ago, myself and Grania, like the PR woman, she's amazing. We said, okay, let's get a Broadway producer to come watch this.
Now, this is interesting because Enter Stage Left... The New York guy.
Yeah.
And this guy, right, could, and this is a musical plot in itself. This guy could change everything for you.
God, so you're
just to put it into context for people, you still have Big Shot. It hasn't hit Broadway or
no,
West End
like
yet.
It sold out the Helix tonight.
Hey, listen, that's not a bad thing at all. But is tonight the night?
Yeah.
Now, who is this man?
So his name's Ken Davenport.
Who is he?
He won the Tonys last year for Once on This Island. And he produced Kinky Boots. He's produced Altar Boys, Avenue Q. Like, he's
okay,
the man.
So this guy is... did he do Once as well? Is that,
No, I don't think so. Sorry.
But he did all these big musicals that yeah. you're talking about. And he is a producer. And yeah. he can make and break something that's
musicals,
off Broadway
yeah.
or off
on
West End.
Yeah, and on
or,
Broadway.
Or on Broadway.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you wrote to him to say what?
I rang him. Well, so I went to a conference that he was at 3 years ago. Myself and Grania went, and we just were like, after the conference, it was about marketing for musical theatre. And after the conference, Grania looked at him and she looked at me and she said, I think he's our producer for Big Shot. And I was like, oh no, I'm too afraid. She's like, come on, we need to go pitch it. I was like, no way. I was too chicken, couldn't pitch it.
I'm surprised to hear that.
Yeah, no, couldn't do it. So we waited 3 years, brought it to London, did a few more things with it, and then rang him a few months ago yeah. and said, we're going to put on a production in February of Big Shot. Now, at this stage, I hadn't a cast or anything already, and I knew I had to rewrite the whole script again after London. But so we, yeah.
And he said?
He said, yeah, I'll come.
To Ireland?
Yeah.
Just for this?
Yeah. So I paid for his flights to come over and his hotel and he's here.
Out of your own pocket?
So, yeah.
So is he,
and
is
I paid
he in,
for this whole production. Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah, I saved up every penny I had. I'd love to bring out an Irish tour, like that's the goal. But obviously I could afford the Helix for one night and I was like, I'll do it. I'll put everything into it.
And he's in town tonight to see your show.
So he arrived like an hour ago. And thanks to Hertz, they gave us a car and drove him. Yeah, Hertz gave us a car and drove him to the hotel.
Did you ask Hertz to do you a favour?
Yeah, because I was like, oh, you're like, I'm kind of running out of funds. So my brother works in Hertz and he pulled us a favour yesterday and they drove him to his hotel just there, like he just arrived. And we sneakily, like, we ran into his hotel last night because I booked it the night before as well in case he came in early. So we went to his hotel last night and we bought all these, like, Irish decorations, and we were like, this is either going to be really creepy or really funny. So we decorated his whole room with all this Irish, like Irish merchandise. Like, we got him his little daughter, like a little t-shirt, and we got him like lucky Irish socks and stuff and Tato crisps. And
I think he might be into that,
yeah,
though.
You know, it, way, like just before I came in the room, I saw on his Instagram, he was like, thanks for the little Irish
charm.
What's
his Instagram? I must have a look at
Ken Davenport Broadway.
Ken Davenport Broadway. Great. And he's here with his daughter, is he?
No, he's here on his own.
Oh, so you got him a gift.
So we just got him a gift.
Wise. Okay, so Ken.
Chances.
And he's in the hotel now going, this is great. Now I've got to go to this gig tonight. It's probably
I hope he's not listening. Because Grania told him on the way here, she's like, Lauren's on the biggest radio station in Ireland this morning.
Hilarious.
But if he's listening, he's going to know I did all this for him.
He is. It's all for you, Ken. Okay, let's go back to this then.
Sorry.
So tonight, how did you raise the funds? This is expensive.
I work in like a few different colleges and music skills, Phoenix and B Music, and I just saved up all my money. Yeah.
Okay, I really admire your commitment to this thing. What are you going to do with Ken, by the way, on his downtime for the weekend?
We're going to the Guinness Storehouse. We're getting a consultation after to see what he thinks of the show. So fingers crossed. Our cast are amazing, though. And our band are like, they're just phenomenal, Ryan. Like, okay. Our band are like, yeah, our cast. Phenomenal.
And that's tonight?
It's tonight,
in
yeah.
The
they're in the Helix right now. Like, we've two techies trying to do the show in a day.
Okay, it's even better. It is absolutely a massive thing to do. But as I say, the musical is nearly the guy coming from Broadway to see that, you know, it's all big. Now, I'm going to play a little clip of one of the songs.
Yeah.
But I think it's you singing, is it?
It's a coffee shop song, do you
yes,
know?
Yes, it is coffee shop
yeah,
song.
Yeah, that's another story I could tell you.
Okay, I want to hear it. Hang on.
When you're sluggish in the morning, can't get out of the bed, get yourself a cup of coffee, it'll cure your head. Mint chocolate chip is the flavor I get. Get the Irish girl to make it, it's the best you've had yet.
All right. Even that, you know, you're already bopping to that. That's great. That has that kind of almost a 50s, 60s sound
yeah,
to it.
Yeah, that's kind of the boppy song of the show. It's kind of a dark, well, it's dark and happy, but yeah, that one is the opener of Act 2, to try get people to sit down and be like, oh, what's going on again?
Get them going.
Yeah.
And your cast, are they all from, how did you
They're
recruit?
All Irish bar one.
Yeah.
Amy Penston is playing Vivian, the girl that sings that song, and like she sings that song way better than I do. She was on West End for The Commitments.
Great.
She's amazing. And then we've like Carl Starward, Circuit. We've just loads and loads of, I can't name them all, there's too many.
So what's
but
the dream?
Irish,
what's the dream, Lauren, after, you know, say after that? Is it Ken puts the cape on and becomes
well,
Superman?
Well, I don't, like, it's my first show, so I'm not naive. Like, I know it's like, it needs probably a lot of work, like, you know, and I've had loads of help from loads of friends, like, would help me writing it and help me fix the music and different things, but I think it might need work. So I just would love to write for Broadway. That would be the dream. Well, I just love writing songs.
Yeah.
I write for my little sister and her best friend, Missy. They're in a band called GGMK. They're on The Voice of
UK. They just missed out, didn't
yeah,
they?
Yeah,
oh,
they're on
God.
The Voice UK
yeah,
last
yeah.
week. I write for them and I write for some of my students. I just love writing, to be honest, so I just love to write.
I think apart from having great skill with music, you have nearly the most important thing of all, which is passion. You know, you meet people who don't have passion and you think, well, that's just not for them and they'll get on with their lives and scram. But you've got it in spades. You want this to work and you want to be there in the middle of it all. So I have no doubt it's going to happen.
Oh,
I have full faith in you.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know you, but I just do. I just got good vibes about it. And I think tonight's going to be great. And I think Ken is going to be wearing his shamrock headband yeah. with bobbles on it. And he's going to be bopping along and having
oh,
a ball.
Oh, God. I hope so.
And the fact that you saved up all your money to bring him over, it's lovely. So
I'm
go.
Just a nutshell, right?
No, you're not. You're just determined and you're passionate. And, you know, we need people like you in the world. So, Lauren, go for it.
Thank you so
Big
much.
Big Shot is the name of the musical.
Yeah,
okay.
thank you.
Well,
that's what
it's written there. So you've got our full support if you need it. Wind in the sails. So set sail and have fun getting there.
Thank you.
I think
you're so
great.
Good.
Good luck with it to you and the cast and all the people, the techies and the musicians and everyone on the ushers and everyone.
We've literally a few hours to get this together, like techie-wise, but we'll do it. We'll do it.
Okay, we're going to follow your star and see how it goes.
Thank you so much,
Thanks, Lauren
Ryan.
Gaffney.
Thank
Lovely
you.
To see you.